You know, thinking, you know, about how we opened up in prayer, and I'm thinking about what we're going to get into in this study. Yesterday, the men were got together, and we talked about prayer and being bold, and thinking about what we pray for. But what we're going to see here in this chapter is sometimes what we see, actually, if not majority of the time, what we see is completely different than what God sees. So when we're bold and praying and, you know, at talking to God in prayer, you know, how are we praying? What are we praying? You know, are we bold and thorough and giving everything to Him, or are we holding out and having certain things because we see things differently? And it may, you know, I kind of thought about, you know, I thought about this this joke that I heard about this hunter. He ran away from this bear, ran up a tree, and the bear just started shaking this tree. And it got to the point where the hunter was like, you know what, I can't hold on much longer. He prayed to God saying, God, I sure hope that this is a Christian bear. And then he fell into the bear's hands. Once the hunter fell into the bear's hands, he looked up, the bear looked up to the heavens and said, Dear Lord, thank you for this meal. Amen. You know, and with that, you know, what do we see that's different than what God sees? And we're going to see that here in Daniel chapter 7. So we're going to be going through a change, and it's moving now from history to prophecy. And because the first six chapters of Daniel is deals with Daniel being taken captive as a young boy from Jerusalem, and that was about 605 BC, and taken into Babylon. And he spent the remainder of his life, from being a youth to the time of being a very old man, he spent it in captivity. Though he spent it in captivity, God really blessed him, and he was given a place of high prominence. And he was given a place of leadership in a foreign country, an unusual kind of position, okay? For a Jewish captive to be set as the second or third in the entire kingdom of Iraq. Remember that Babylon is the same area as modern Iraq. And so the first six chapters, historical with a little bit of prediction, but the last six chapters are mostly prediction with a little bit of history. So we kind of see how these roles are. And, you know, sometimes people look at the Bible as being a dead book, and that, or it's irrelevant, or they marginalize it. It's out of date. It doesn't have anything to do with real life. It's dead, and they say all this stuff. And when they say this stuff, you know, you think about, okay, once upon a time, there was this man, you know, think about that. There's a story I heard, a man who thought that he was dead. And this man, the story that I heard, this man thought he was dead. It disturbed his wife, his friends. And they're like, hey, this guy needs a psychiatrist. So they took him to the doctor. The doctor decided, you know, he would convince the man that he wasn't dead, but by one basic fact. And that fact is that dead men do bleed. So the next several months, they gave him medical books, invited him to see an autopsy. After months, the man finally said, okay, you're right. I give up. I agree. Dead men don't bleed. Immediately, the doctor took out a needle and poked the man in the arm, and he started spurting out blood, and the patient looked at him and said, oh my goodness, what do you know? Dead men do bleed. And so thinking about bleeding, today we're going to poke at the Bible and watch it bleed the truth, okay? And with that, we have to understand that the truth that we're going to read, to not only know what you believe, but why you believe what you believe, okay? And this is a dare that, you know, to put up a defense for the faith, to give reason when people ask you, why do you believe it? especially if you're out there knocking at doors or sharing at work, you're going to have those that ask you why. Okay. And, you know, whenever I'm talking with people, you know, I want people to interrupt me and ask me questions. I want someone to ask me if I believe in the Bible or those stories in the Bible. And, you know, that leads on to further sharing the gospel. You know, there's this college professor, Carl Henry, when they asked him if he believed in Jonah, this guy asked the professor how Jonah could survive being in the whale, being deprived of oxygen. And he went through this list. And the professor said, "Sir, I don't know the answer to all your questions, but when I get to heaven, I'll ask Jonah." And the guy said, "Yeah, but what if Jonah isn't in heaven?" And then this professor said, "Well, then you can ask him." And, you know, so thinking about how do we respond, you know, and talk about this, what opportunities will we have, you know, when they get interrupted? And if the people are going to sit there and dig and dig and dig and try to find reasons why not to believe, you know, are we prepared to, you know, hey, show them the gospel, show them, you know, what's happened in the past to what's been verified and, you know, and showing the truth and plant the seed. You know, it's not up to us to force someone to believe. We're just there to share it and plant a seed and let God take it from there. You know, this professor could have went on and tried to convince them, but he just left it at that. So let's begin in verse 1 and see what Daniel documented about the future. Verse 1, it says, "In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions of his head as he lay in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter." Okay, so a vision came to Daniel after the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, before the Babylonian Empire was conquered by a Medo-Persian Empire. Okay, so what we got to know about this chapter here is the order of events. The vision that's described here in Daniel chapter 7 took place between Daniel chapters 4 and 5. So, and you're going to see why as we go through. You know, you might sit there and say, well, we've already talked about Belshazzar, the lion's den, and kind of going forward. And right now we're kind of going to jump. The time frame is between Daniel's chapter 4 and 5. Okay. So Daniel is now has his own vision. And it's not an interpretation of someone else's dream. It's his own vision given by God to the prophet. And I'm sure that he had a restless night that night, okay? After this vision, he couldn't turn around. He couldn't go to sleep. He could, you know, it was really just kind of tackling him down. And he saw something different than what had happened with Nebuchadnezzar. He saw a succession of four kingdoms, but not as four metals on a polished, gorgeous statue. He saw four wild, ravenous beasts tearing things into pieces. And so here's the question, okay? Why a repeat vision? God had already given to Nebuchadnezzar and eventually to Daniel the plan of the future, but why a repeat of it? Okay. And it's because I believe that you're seeing the same vision, but from two different perspectives. One is from a man's perspective, this beautiful, polished, impressive image, but the other is from God's point of view, the ravenous beast tearing at one another. And with this, you know, I really thought about this when I'm reading this, the two different perspectives, okay? God and man see differently, okay? The way that we see isn't necessarily the way that God sees it. A good case in point is in the study of the first few chapters of Revelation, there are two churches. One is poor and one is rich. Now, they were physically in the early church poor. And Jesus said, though you're poor physically, you're rich. And God is saying, I see it differently than you see it. You have riches in heaven. Though you might be poor now, we see that God sees differently than man. The church of Laodicea, I know your works, how you say that you're rich and increased with goods and have need of nothing. Okay. But you do not know that you're wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked. Okay. So they saw themselves as having need of nothing, but Jesus saw them as being blind and poor and having need of everything. Okay. So we can see how God and man see different ways. And of course, the prophet said, man looks at the outward appearance, God looks at the heart. Man looks at a beautiful image, gold, silver, brass, and iron, but God sees beneath that image the heart of a ravenous beast. Okay. So Daniel, he could have given us more detail, but the Holy Spirit only wanted him to write the main facts. And we may wish that Daniel went into greater detail, but he didn't. Let's look at verses 2 and 3. It says, Daniel declared, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another. All right, so four beasts, and where did they come from? Okay, so the four nations, perhaps the nations around the sea that Daniel sees, coming up out from the sea. This reminds us a little bit about the Revelation 13, where Daniel sees the beast, the false prophet, arising out of the sea. Now, another question, what is the sea? If you're thinking in terms of a Jew, you would think of the Mediterranean Sea. There was three seas to the Jews: Sea of Galilee, which is the north, the Dead Sea, the south, and the Great Sea, the Mediterranean Sea, off to its western border. So this sea is almost certainly the Mediterranean Sea, and each one of the empires mentioned in this vision border the Mediterranean Sea. Revelation 17, verse 15 tells us Great Sea refers to the nations of the world. Thus, out of the nations of the world, four beasts will arise. The word sea also is often used to speak of wicked nations. The wicked, which we see Isaiah says, are like the sea that is churning and turning up its sand and mire. Okay. And God speaks of the Gentile nations that we see in Isaiah 17 as being formed roughly, windy, like the sea that is tossed. So that's kind of what it's saying there. And so it could be the nations that are rising just out of Gentile rulership around Israel. And there's a key about this, that when we see these nations, that I want you to keep in your mind. And that is that I want you to take out as we go through. I want you to also think about this as we go through this the next few weeks as well. And we're going to start to see a succession of the worldly kingdoms. And we're going to see several visions. But the center of the vision will always be Jesus. So next to that epicenter will be the nation of Israel. And Israel plays the key of the prophetic future. And we read last week that how Daniel prayed, okay? He faced where? Jerusalem. And every Jew would face Jerusalem, and they still do to this day. Jerusalem is the nerve center of the world, geographically. It's the center of the earth. Ezekiel 5, God says, I have set Jerusalem in the middle of the nations. In Deuteronomy, God said that he established the boundaries of the children of men according to the number of the children of Israel. So Jerusalem's the salvation center of the world spiritually. Also, you're going to read in Daniel, Jerusalem's the storm center of the world prophetically. And you can read also in Zechariah, Matthew, Revelation, and Daniel that the world will always look at Israel because it's the storm center of the world prophetically. So then we have the four large ferocious animals emerge from the great sea, each distinct from the other. And we're going to see that. Let's look at verses 4-6. It says, the first was like an lion and eagles had eagle's wings. Then as I looked, its wings were plucked off and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. And the mind of a man was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, like a bear, it was raised up on one side. It had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, arise, devour much flesh. After this, I looked, and behold, another, like a leopard, had four wings of a bird on its back. And the beast had four heads, and dominion was given to it. So, what are we seeing here? We are seeing this picture, okay? And now, you know, first of all, picture this, okay? You're an 85-year-old man. You've gone to bed. You haven't had pizza, burritos, or tacos. Your diet's been kosher, and yet you're dreaming like crazy, okay? The first thing that Daniel sees was a lion that had eagle's wings. Being a man who was a ruler in Babylon, Daniel knew when he saw that lion with wings on it what it was. Or he had an inclination, at least, that until the interpretation was given to him by an angel. The first kingdom, Babylonian Empire, represented by a lion and an eagle, fits in well with the majesty and authority of Nebuchadnezzar in reign over the empire of Babylon. Jeremiah used both the lion and the eagle as pictures of Nebuchadnezzar in Jeremiah 49:19-22. There in Babylon, painted on the walls, even till today, after Saddam Hussein had rebuilt part of it, there's a depiction of a lion majestic standing on a pedestal with wings on it. And the lion was a symbol of Babylon because of the lion as being fierce, majestic beast. And wings speak of the ability of this beast to be able to move and conquer at a quick pace. And now, like, think about Nebuchadnezzar, is that Nebuchadnezzar took over the known world with great speed. He had an incredible force, not in terms of the mighty or large army, but he was just quick. He was mighty. Even when he was contended against, he could, with great speed, subdue another army. His people learned over the years that the key to the military victory was getting the job done quickly, getting a lot of power, getting a lot of firepower, manpower, whatever it is, but doing it quickly and not just mulling around. And Napoleon found that out. Caesars of Rome found that out. Alexander the Great found that out. Alexander won by sheer speed and genius, though he had a small army. Think about the Gulf War in the past. We saw and learned from that history that if you're going to do the job, get the men there quick, bring lots of weapons, lots of missiles, lots of air power, and let them strike at night and do it massively. And it's a lesson. That's how nations are subdued and wars are prevented from going on too long. So such was a takeover when Babylon became the center, the first world governing power during Daniel's time. Okay. And then we see in verse 4, it said, and I watched, and its wings were plucked off. This majestic beast is humbled and made human. And that happened to Nebuchadnezzar, didn't it? He stood in his palace one day. He said, you know what? I'm a pretty fabulous person. In fact, I love myself greatly because I'm so wonderful. Forget God, I'm in charge here. That's what he said. And we remember what God did to him. He gave him the heart of a beast and made him eat grass until certain seasons passed over him. And when he finally repented, God set him back on his feet and gave him the heart of a man once again. So we read here, you know, he was lifted from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. So we see that. Now, then we see the second beast. This another beast that's like a bear, was raised up on one side, 3 ribs in its mouth, between its teeth. This second beast does not have majestic bearing of either a lion or an eagle. The bear is slower but stronger, and it has more crushing power than a lion, and has a ferocious appetite, okay? And this bear represents the Medo-Persian Empire, succeeding the Babylonian Empire. It raised up on one side because it's coalition. The Persians were stronger than the Medes, and there wasn't a balance of power at the beginning. But the 3 ribs in its mouth, because the 3 nations, Lydia, Egypt, and Babylon knew that she was in trouble, called upon 2 other nations. And this coalition, but the Medes and the Persians wiped them out, or you can see it there and see in the verse, devoured much flesh. So this bear isn't known for its swiftness, but its strength. And now I say it's not known for its swiftness, okay? But you'd be in dire straits trying to outrun one. And if you try to compare it to other animals in the kingdom, animal kingdom, it's not as swift as some, but it is strong. It is very strong. Now, thinking about this, after this, there's another one, right? Now they're seeing a leopard, which had on its back 4 wings of a bird. And this beast also had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. Okay. The leopard is known for its sudden, unexpected attacks, especially swift and clever. The leopard represents the Greek Empire. Alexander the Great quickly conquered the civilized world by the age of 28. Okay. But after his death, the empire divided into 4 parts. We see that it says in the verse, 4 heads, the 4 of his generals, because they knew that they could not ever follow his footsteps and take over everything. Okay. And those 4 generals, it was, I might butcher their names, but it's Lysimachus was given Asia Minor. Cassander was given Macedonia. Ptolemy was given Egypt, and Seleucus was given Syria. So let's look at verses 7-8. It says, after this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, the 4th beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke into pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up them another horn, a little one, before which the 3 of the first horns were plucked by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like a man, like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. So, the 4th beast, dreadful horned beast with 1 conspicuous horn. Okay. After this night vision, fourth beast, it's terrible, exceedingly strong, indescribable, but it's uniquely horrific in its power and conquest. Okay. It's different from all the other beasts before it. This one has the 10 horns, and then another one, a little one. And in the ancient world, the horns expressed an animal's power, the fearsomeness. This 4th beast is so strong that it has 10 horns. And then there is a horn where eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth, speaking blasphemous and pompous words. So with this, thinking about this, different people picture this different ways. Okay, some suggest that the 10 horns were actually 2 5-pointed antlers rather than 10 separate horns. But however, regardless, okay, this 4th beast, there's 10 horns, okay? And then it has another little one that's coming up. And this 4th beast, represents the Roman Empire, the largest, the strongest, the most unified and enduring of them all. And we look back and we see that everything Daniel predicted has came true. Babylon has fell to the Medo-Persians. The Medo-Persians fell to Alexander the Great, the Grecian Empire. And then Grecian Empire fell onto the Roman Empire. And then the Roman Empire fell to no one. It was corrupted from the inside and broken up into various nations. That is now Europe. And the Bible predicts that there will be a coalition of nations in the last days, and there will be 10 of them. So the arising from the nations will come one person who, upon his takeover, will subdue three kingdoms and rally the others around them. And he will be numero uno. He's speaking of this blasphemous and pompous things, none other than the Antichrist or whatever one of the 50 titles that you want to ascribe to him. Let's look at verses 9 through 10. It says here, as I looked, thrones were placed and the Ancient of the Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow and the hair of his head looked, like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames. Its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. 1,000 thousands served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. Okay, so kind of, you know, once we saw the aspects of these horns, okay, now we're kind of talking about these ancient days and the scene surrounding this throne, okay? And we're going to get back to this beast here in a second, but now we're kind of in this courtroom scene in heaven, okay? And it should remind us of Revelation chapter 4, where John said, I saw a God sitting upon the throne. He was seated, and there were 24 other thrones with elders that were seated around him. Okay. So Daniel makes no mention of those who sit on the thrones, perhaps because the 24 elders represent the church, and the church was an unrevealed mystery to Old Testament saints. We see it, but also Ephesians 3 verses 1 through 7. Okay. But Revelation shows us when this will happen. And when Jesus returns in Revelation 19, a sharp sword goes from his mouth. He will devour his enemies. Okay. And then we kind of jump over to Revelation chapter 20. John saw a lake burning with fire and brimstone, and the devil was cast into the lake along with the beasts and false prophet. Okay. This is a brilliant manifestation of God's splendor and the fierce heat of his judgment. And there was something like a lava-like in this stream of fire pouring from the throne. It's a river that of vast destructive power. Isaiah 66:15 describes the judgment in terms of fire. For behold, for the Lord will come with fire and with his chariots, like a whirlwind to render his anger with fury, and his rebuke with flames of fire. For by fire and by his sword, the Lord will judge all flesh, and the slain of the Lord shall be many. So we see here the ancient days of the reigns, and it talks about the thrones and descriptions of the burning fire and going through that. But now we're going to be jumping to verse 11 through 14, the kind of going back to this beast, and you're going to kind of see how the pieces of this kind of fit together and what's happening here. This conspicuous horn is conquered by the Son of Man. Okay. Verse 11 through 14, it says, I looked then because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking. And as I looked, the beast was killed and its body destroyed, and given over to be burned with fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man. And he came to the ancient days and was presented before him, and to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is in the everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. So here, the great passage that describes the transition from a human dominion on earth to a divine dominion. Okay. This happens as the Son of Man comes and exercises dominion over the earth. The Son of Man succeeds the reign of the fourth beast, this fourth horrible beast. Okay. Here, the little horn of the fourth beast again speaks pompous words. But the final human dictator, we commonly call the Antichrist, will be characterized by his boastful, blasphemous speech. And we see that in Revelation 13, 5 through 6. Okay. Because of the distinction between the fourth beast and the horn, some conjecture that the beast of Revelation 13 isn't the Antichrist, but his state. Now, okay. And then also thinking the fourth beast is destroyed and others may continue, but without dominion of their own. So now, okay, we got to think about this with this Antichrist, okay? When Jesus sets up his kingdom, okay, the empire of the Antichrist will be completely crushed. Yet some nations will continue into the millennium. The Son of Man is the smiting stone of Daniel chapter 2 that comes out of the heaven and breaks the image into pieces. It was seen as the stone, right? And here it's seen as the Son of Man. A man, the Messiah, coming to set up his kingdom. Okay? Jesus is the rock. He'll set up the kingdom that will never be destroyed. It will not pass away. His kingdom, the one which shall never be destroyed. Jesus, when he stood before Pilate, Pilate said, "Are you a king?" And Jesus said, "Yes. But not my kingdom isn't of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my subjects would rise up and fight, but my kingdom is not of this world." Okay. Now, we also see the Revelation, Revelation chapter 11 is the fulfillment of the conversation before Pilate. The seventh angel declares that kingdoms of this earth have become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ. So now, the fulfillment of that right here, the same as Revelation chapter 11. Verse 15 through 16, it says, "As for me, Daniel, my spirit within me was anxious, and the visions of my head alarmed me. I approached one of those who stood there and asked him the truth concerning all this. So he told me, and made known to me the interpretation of the things. The four great beasts are four kings who shall arise out of the earth, but the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, forever, and ever." And then, I'm sorry. I think I jumped around here. Let me reread that again here. "As for me, Daniel, my spirit is within me, was anxious, and the visions of my head alarmed me. I approached one of these." Yes, so I read that. So it talks about these kings. I run on to verse 19. But so Daniel, okay, kind of reading, seeing what we just read through in the last few verses, Daniel had seen all this. And in more detail than he describes for us, shows that our spirit indeed dwells within the body. Okay. He didn't really understand all that he saw and was troubled because of his lack of understanding. The summary of these visions, the four kings and the conquered by God and their kingdoms are given to the people of God. He's puzzled about this whole fourth beast thing. Now keep in mind, Daniel's adept at prophecy at the time. The five books of Moses were already in existence. Psalms were in existence. We know that Daniel read in captivity the book of Jeremiah, because we know that Daniel read Jeremiah 25 to know 70 years of captivity were about up. So there's divine intervention of this dream that shows that this vision covers the same material as Nebuchadnezzar's vision of Daniel chapter 2, which is described as these four empires, which are succeeded by the kingdom of God. Yet Daniel's vision, Daniel is having a different vision. He's seeing the kingdoms from God's perspective, not man's. Nebuchadnezzar saw present and future world empires in the form of a stately and noble statue of a man. But here, God shows how he sees them as a ferocious and wild animals who devour and conquer without conscience. When a man writes down his own history, there's often much self-congratulation. And we seem to be on the verge of paradise, right? When God writes human history, a different vision is presented than what we see. But yet we know the Roman Empire here is already long gone, and it doesn't seem that the saints have received the kingdom, okay? So what's happening here, right? There's two different, you know, things going on. But we also see that God gives them the kingdom at the return of Jesus. They don't gain dominion over all these earthly kingdoms before the return of Jesus. So Daniel has now has a specific request to know about this conspicuous horn, though, from these beasts. And we'll read on to verse 22. It says, "Then I desire to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the rest, exceedingly terrifying, with its teeth of iron and claws of bronze, and which devoured and broke into pieces and stamped with what was left with its feet, and about the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn that came up, and before which three of them fell, the horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke great things and seemed greater than its companions. As I looked, this horn made war with the saints and prevailed over them until the ancient days came and the judgment was given for the saints of the Most High. And the time came when the saints possessed the kingdom." So here, there's much interest in these four beasts, but Daniel is more interested in this fourth, most terrible beast, okay? This fourth beast interests Daniel because of the great destructive power, the conspicuous horn, because of its fight against God's people. If this horn is the Antichrist and he fights against the saints, does this mean that the church will be on the earth as a target of the Antichrist during tribulation? Not necessarily, because the saints can indicate the church or a Jewish remnant in the tribulation, which is in Revelation chapter 12, verse 17. We also see it in chapter 13, verse 7. And then it kind of goes on to this, the meaning of the conspicuous horn and its defeat in the next several verses. I'll just go ahead and read off into verse 28. It says, "Thus he said, as for the fourth beast, there shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all the kingdoms, and it shall devour the whole earth and trample it down and break it into pieces. As for the 10 horns out of this kingdom, 10 kings shall arise, and another shall arise from them. He shall be different from the former ones and shall put down three kings. He shall speak words against the Most High. He shall wear out the saints of the Most High and shall think to change the times and the law. And they shall be given into his hand for a time and a half of a time. But the court shall sit in judgment and his dominion shall be taken away to be consumed and destroyed to the end. And the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. His kingdom shall be the everlasting kingdom, and that all dominions shall serve and obey him. Here is the end of this matter. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly alarmed me, and my color changed, but I kept the matter in my heart." So This description of the fourth beast, it fits well with the Roman Empire of ancient history. It devoured the whole civilized earth and dominated it completely for about 1,000 years. The 10 kings do not have a literal fulfillment in the Roman Empire of history. If they're literal, then they're still in the future. Only way to say this has been fulfilled is to spiritualize this prophecy and take away its plain sense. So, but if we get this picture, the fourth and final empire, Roman Empire, out of it will grow the four kingdoms. Just like the horns grow out of the head of an animal, they'll be given authority. But the one who will take all the authority will be the 11th horn, the little horn. And the Bible has a lot of these terms for him, just like we kind of talked about it a minute ago. One of them is used is Antichrist. Throughout history, people try to guess who it is. It started back in about AD 37, when some Christians thought it was Caligula because he had an image of himself that was put on the altar. Others in AD 57 said it must be Caesar Nero. Look how he's persecuting the saints, the Christians. There have been many guesses. Martin Luther, John Wycliffe thought it was the Pope of their time. Others have said it was Adolf Hitler. Some said it was even JFK. So people wonder who this Antichrist is, okay? Well, the answer is we don't know, and we shouldn't care. The Bible instructs us not to look for the Antichrist, but to look for Jesus Christ. I'm looking for his appearance, his coming, his kingdom of Jesus Christ. But once again, the mouth is mentioned. He's a little horn with a big mouth. He's a sharp guy, sharp in a lot of ways. He's brilliant. He's able to bring the nations together, but he speaks very arrogantly, very pompously. Look, we see in Revelation 13, he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he opened his mouth with blasphemy against God, blasphemy in his name, and the tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. Okay, he's going to have a unique oratorical skills. He's going to be able to sway people by them. He'll be able to have an incredible amount of charisma, style, all that stuff. But he also speaks of cruel and systematic pressures coming from the word to wear away or to wear out, right? He's trying to wear them out, which we saw in the verse, as friction wears clothes or shoes. The little horn will intend to change the times and the laws, perhaps just like with the French Revolution in 1792, right? The radicals wanted to institute a 10-day work week as year one. And some think the Antichrist will manage to do what others have tried to do in the past, but unsuccessfully. That is, change the calendar. That it was attempted in history and failed. This power of the little horn over the saints is limited. It says in the scripture here, and it'll last about 3.5 years. In the day of persecution, the blasphemous ruler Jesus will establish his kingdom for his people, though. The kingdom and dominion of this earth certainly does not belong to the righteous right now. If this describes the eternal state, then what are the dominions that shall serve and obey him? We again notice that the kingdom and dominion shall be given to the saints. It'll be something received, not achieved. The church does not convert the word to Jesus's kingdom and give the kingdom to the Jesus. He gives it to them. And then we also see that Daniel's troubled. He has a troubled reaction to the vision and its interpretation. Many things trouble Daniel at this vision. The ferocity of the attack to come against his people from the conspicuous horn. Daniel was convinced that this was true and the word of God. He was convinced of its truth, that his countenance changed. He considered what would happen. There is a coming monarch, a world ruler. From where? I don't know. Who? I don't know. But he'll not be rejected. He'll be wanted. He'll be magical. He'll be mysterious. He'll have the ability to sway the nations of the world around him. He'll come up with a peace plan. It'll evolve the Arabs in Israel. It'll seem perfect. He'll help the Jewish rebuild their long-awaited temple. They're now yearning to build. He settled the problem of the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Just when peace seems to be in the forefront, he'll break his covenant, and the nations of the world will see it. This man's a fraud. But at this point, he'll establish an economic system. Revelation tells us the world will become so entrenched in that they cannot survive without buying into his political system. During that time, Jesus Christ will come back, and it says his kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. Now, Daniel's thoughts troubled him, okay? But there's one thought that comforted him. Is that there is a kingdom that's coming that is an everlasting kingdom. This should show us something. Man's never been able to successfully govern himself. There were monarchs and they failed. There were monarchs that failed and Nebuchadnezzar thought he could do it. Others thought they can do it. Belshazzar thought he could. Cyrus thought he could. All the Caesars thought they could. Politicians still think they can. But guess what? Man cannot govern himself. A monarchy nor democracy is the answer. You can sound pretty anti-American, or you can say that I sound anti-American, but I'm not. Look what's happening to us around this world. How successful have we been able to govern ourselves? I admit it. We used to be the best nation in the world. And some of you might say, how can you say that? We used to be number one in many things, but are we still? The United States is ranked 30th in math, 8th in reading, 11th in science, 15th in the quality of life, 27th in healthcare. You know where we rank number one in? Power, international influence, media consumption, and there's others. But you know what? We are a great nation. We have to pray for our nation, our leaders, because I believe that this nation was founded under God. But the more we are leaving that place of worship of God, the worse we're going to get. The only successful form of government is a theocracy. And that's how God started with the children of Israel, as he guided them through the wilderness. But they wanted a king. And that's where the trouble began. One day, God will set up his kingdom. God will rule and reign and govern this earth. Man will be as God intended him to become. It shows us also something else. We as individuals are incapable of governing our own life. We might think we're smart. We might think that we made it this far. We've even got a degree in college. We're doing pretty good. We made great decisions. We are successful in business. But that's good. God has given you some incredible ability. But deep down inside, there's a gnawing for answers, like Nebuchadnezzar as he turned upon his bed. What's the purpose of life? What does the future hold? I sincerely believe with all my heart that you'll never come to rest until you come to a place in your life, place your life in God's hands. For him to govern your life. Nations are like the sea, tossed with winds and distress, and it'll get worse. We read it and watch it in the news. It's getting worse. Maybe a turn for worse, we don't know. But there's peace. Jesus promises peace within the heart of the people who know and receive Jesus. Jesus taught us to pray, "Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come." Do you pray that? Do you long for it? After that, he said, "Thy will be done in earth as it is in heaven." You see, he can and will establish his kingdom in your heart. And for most, it's done already.